what's next in the threat and the chaos of the war on women's reproductive rights?
More than half of abortions are done by medication, and it makes it a pretty seamless process up until around 11 weeks. Because more than half of abortions are done with medication, that's now become the next biggest target of the anti-abortion movement, right? Because if more than half of people are doing something that you want to ban by a certain method, what's the best way to take your goal to the next level? It's restricting access to that method. And so that's why we're seeing too many efforts to talk about here at both the state and federal level to restrict access to the mifepristone, which is one of two of the main drugs used for medication abortion. So this has created more legal chaos.
That's Amanda Becker. We talk with her about her groundbreaking book, You Must Stand Up, The Fight for Abortion Rights in Post-Dobbs America. But first, we play an excerpt from my 2022 conversation with Laura Kaplan about her book, Jane, The Women of the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service. It's about how a group of ordinary women worked together to create an underground women-centered abortion service that operated in Chicago from 1969 to 1973, until Roe versus Wade made it unnecessary. Let's listen now to that clip from our 2022 conversation. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, compelling conversations with authors who challenge, inspire, and inform. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, let's listen back to a clip from my 2022 conversation with Laura Kaplan about her book, Jane. Nearly 50 years ago, women in America gained the constitutional right to abortion. In June of this year, they lost that right. What was it like before Roe versus Wade? I remember it well. It was a terrifying time to be a woman, as it is now, again. The women's liberation movement of that earlier time organized abortion services all across the nation. The most legendary and unique was the Abortion Counseling Service of Women's Liberation in Chicago, a.k.a. Jane. The service's advertisement said, "Pregnant? Don't want to be? Call Jane." One of Jane's members was Laura Kaplan. Her 1995 book about the group, Jane, has just been reissued with a new introduction by the author. It comes at a time when you can view HBO's terrific new documentary, The Janes. But the book adds much more detail to that story. Here's our conversation with Laura Kaplan. Laura Kaplan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
The story of Jane, the legendary underground feminist abortion service. Jane was started in 1969, 4 years before Roe v. Wade legalized abortion. You joined in 1971. How did you get involved?
So I had been a student at the University of Chicago when I graduated in 69, moved back to New York, and then moved back to Chicago in the fall of 71. And my very dear friend Alice, who was still a student at the University of Chicago, discovered she was pregnant. And she looked around for an abortion, and she saw in an underground newspaper an ad that said something like, "Pregnant, don't want to be, call Jane," with the number. So she called. And after her abortion, she came over to my apartment, and she was so thrilled and excited by the experience that, as I often say, she was almost bouncing off the walls. And I thought, this is pretty interesting. And she was excited not because only because she was no longer pregnant, but because the experience had been so unique and so fulfilling in so many ways for her. Educationally, she felt like she was getting educated. She felt that she was really the center of the experience. She was just thrilled. So she took me to meet her counselor, who lived a few blocks from me. And her counselor told us that they were starting a new training session. And so I said, oh, I think I'll do this. And so I went. And that's how I got into Jane.
And that's such a great story because it really centers on how different, how radically different Jane was as an abortion service than, of course, any other that existed at that time. But first about the book. The story of Jane was first released in, I believe it was 1995. Is that correct?
That's the pub date. It actually, you know, I really think it came out in January of 96.
And now it's out in a new edition. You have a preface to the new edition in which you say that the history of Jane can serve as a vehicle to explore what community organizing is. What do you mean by that?
So I was, for most of my professional life, I was a community organizer. And I saw this story as a way to talk about organizing on many different levels with a really exciting twist.
An exciting twist?
With an exciting twist, because this is a story. And at the time I started working on the book, Jane was known, but not well known. You know, we used to say in Chicago in the days that we were working that it was the best known secret in the city of Chicago. And I think in the women's movement, it was sort of the best known secret. So most people, I don't think, knew about what we did. And I really felt like I wanted to document as much as I could our history before we'd forgotten all about it. And even then, and that was, you know, 15 years after we folded, what I discovered is that a lot of us forgot a lot of things. And because we were an illegal organization, of course, we kept no records. So the only way to tell this story was through the memories and the voices of the people who were part of it. So that's what I attempted to do, to weave together hours and hours and hours and hours of interviews into a coherent tale.
You also say that you wanted to write the story rather than somebody leave it to somebody else who was not part of Jane, because you were afraid that an outsider would paint the women of Jane as superheroes. You say that it's the opposite of the truth. Why?
Well, I think what's really important, or one of the things, there's many things that are, I think, important about the story, but one of the things that is important is for readers, especially young readers, to sit down with a book and hear our memories and think to themselves, oh, this could be me. And when you paint people as heroes, courageous, you know, whatever, those are all external terms. We certainly didn't see ourselves that way. What I say always is that we were ordinary women who found ourselves in extraordinary circumstances and were able to accomplish something truly extraordinary. And I wanted younger people especially to have that same sense that if they organized with others, they could do things they never dreamed they could do, because we for sure never dreamed that we would do what we did.
That was Laura Kaplan, a member of the legendary underground feminist abortion service, Jane, talking with us in 2022 about her book. Go to writersvoice.net or subscribe to the podcast to hear the full interview. Now, let's turn to our main segment today, part of our programming for Women's History Month. On June 24th, 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court issued the Dobbs decision. With a stroke of the pen, the court stripped away the constitutional right to abortion. abandoning almost 50 years of precedent, the decision gave states carte blanche to ban abortion. As author and journalist Amanda Becker tells us on the following conversation, we've never had a Supreme Court decision in modern history that took a constitutional right away from more than half the country. Becker tells us about the impact of the Dobbs decision, the legal chaos that followed, and how the fight for abortion rights continues. She shares insights from her book, You Must Stand Up, detailing the rollback of reproductive rights, the history of anti-abortion legislation, and the movement's ongoing efforts to restore access through ballot measures, legal strategies, and political action. Let's listen now. Amanda Becker, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this was just such a terrific and important book. It reports on the impact of the anti-abortion laws, including the Dobbs decision, and the response to them by the abortion rights movement. At that moment, you write in I believe it's the first chapter in the book, you write about Robin Marty of the West Alabama Women's Center. She was doing an interview when the decision came down. Tell us a little bit about her and what the impact of that decision was right then on her clinic.
Yeah, so Robin Marty is, she kind of runs a clinic. I actually don't know what her current title is because it's changed a couple times. She's not a healthcare provider herself. She actually came up kind of in the liberal blogosphere and then was working for a newsroom that only writes about abortion and reproductive health called Rewire. And then as we saw states in various parts of the country start to pass really restrictive laws ahead of Dobbs, she reached a point where she thought she needed to be in direct service and, you know, facilitation of services rather than writing about the movements. So she moved from Minnesota to Alabama to work at a clinic down there. First, she was working for an abortion fund and then a clinic. And kind of doing their comms. And, you know, she's a woman who wears many hats. She had agreed to be on live television on the day that the decision came out, because typically there are what is called just decision days for the Supreme Court's decisions. This is, you know, a time when you know decisions will be released. You don't necessarily know which decisions will be released. But the closer they get to the end of their term in the summer, they start, you know, dumping a lot of decisions on one day, and they also start adding days. So when she had agreed to be on live television, it wasn't a Supreme Court decision day. Then they added that as a decision day. And they had people in the clinic because, you know, because of the leak of the Dobbs decision, it gave a window for clinics to prepare, right? They could come up with contingency plans and what was going to happen when the decision came out. And, you know, lawyers were on deck to kind of let them know what they could still do after the decision came out, depending on what it was. And so she was on live TV. There were a couple dozen patients waiting at the clinic for their first day appointments for, because, you know, a lot of states, including Alabama, have a waiting period. And so she had to, you know, leave live television and call the clinic after getting a couple texts from the lawyer they were working with telling them that they needed to stop providing medical care.
Yeah, and this decision actually caused legal chaos in a number of the states, including Alabama and Louisiana, immediately following. Why was that?
So, you know, I actually think Arizona is an even more salient example. Louisiana kind of went back and forth for a while. But Arizona, there were three different abortion bans on the books in Arizona. There was a 15-week ban, and eventually that is what ended up going into effect. But right after the decision, they didn't know whether it would be that 15-week ban, which was the one that they'd passed recently. A law from before Arizona was a state and was a U.S. territory that was a full abortion ban. Or there was also some fetal personhood language on the books in another law. And so there was a period of several months in Arizona where things went back and forth and nobody knew, including the Republican lawmakers who had passed the 15-week ban, which of those three laws was in place. And so that was creating a situation where, you know, the doctor running that clinic that I followed out in Arizona, Gabrielle Goodrick, Dr. Goodrick, she was going, you know, on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, trying to figure out, could she open the clinic? Could she not open the clinic? If she could open the clinic, what type of services could they provide? And they had to get very creative during that period in order to deliver services for their patients. Now, of course, Arizona, just in the November elections, voters protected abortion and overturned even that 15-week ban. So abortion is now legal in Arizona again.
And thank God for that. And we'll talk more about exactly those kinds of responses a little bit later. But just to stay on the chaos, you have an example in Louisiana. You write that if you were a doctor in Louisiana, in just over a month, abortion went from legal to illegal, to legal for now, to illegal for now, to legal again for now, to illegal pending the outcome of the underlying lawsuit. And there was legal turmoil in Michigan, too. So this was not, you know, Arizona is not an outlier. If you could talk more broadly about why there is this chaos and what does it mean for, you know, for the fight for abortion rights.
Yeah, so a lot of the chaos is because, you know, Arizona wasn't just not an outlier in terms of the chaos. It wasn't the only place that had a very, very old law on the books. Many of these laws were pre-Civil War. All of them, I think, were before women could vote in this country, these full abortion bans that, you know, they were kind of these sleeper laws or, you know, that were still on the books but weren't being enforced because of Roe v. Wade. But they had never been officially repealed. So once Roe was no longer the standard and the law of the land, all of these laws were technically live again. And so that's what happened in Michigan. That happened a lot of other places. So that was one thing that was creating chaos. And it was a lot of chaos even just from those old laws. There were other, you know, situations in which states like Texas were trying to not only ban abortion in Texas, but make it more difficult for people to cross state lines to get care from doctors in other places. And so you saw states like Massachusetts, for example, passing a shield law for abortion providers that I followed in the book. But, you know, all of this was happening in real time and people were trying to have to kind of build the plane as they were flying it in terms of responding to the Dobbs decision. You know, they did get kind of a month long period between the leak of the decision and the actual decision to, you know, put the initial steps in place that they would need to take. But no, this has never happened in modern history, right? We've never had a Supreme Court decision in modern history that took a right, a constitutional right away from people. And this decision took a constitutional right away from more than half of the country. And so just, you know, I know that in, I don't have the exact language in front of me, but the justices, the conservative justices who wrote the majority opinion in Dobbs said that, you know, this would solve all of the legal questions raised by Roe and take the issue out of the courts. And in fact, what we've seen is the exact opposite. And it was immediate and it continues to this day.
Yeah. And how did Justice Alito's interpretation of the 14th Amendment threaten other constitutional rights?
Well, you really saw this come up in a concurrent opinion written by Justice Clarence Thomas, where he just comes out and says, you know, this could impact marriage equality. This could impact the right to contraception that was, you know, resulted from a Supreme Court case called Griswold. So these are, you know, civil rights are intertwined. And so when you start to unravel that ball of yarn, it can happen quite quickly. And one erosion of a right can lead to another erosion of a different right that is related.
And kind of related to this also is that in this book, you make a connection, although the book really does deal with abortion rights, you make a strong connection between that and gender rights, the right to a gender-affirming care, the rights of trans people. So connect the dots for us.
Yeah, I mean, they're all, these rights were all protected when they were protected, they were undergirded by the same Supreme Court decisions, the same federal laws. So, you know, that's all part of the ball of yarn. And so, like, in Massachusetts, when, you know, which is a state where the vast majority of people want legal abortion, it's a liberal-leaning state, when they started to try to come up with their response to Dobbs, which they started doing before Dobbs happened, by the way, they did it ahead of time when they saw some of the laws that Texas was passing. They knew immediately that part of their coalition needed to be the LGBTQ rights groups who were working on protecting trans rights. Because when you erode the right to abortion, which is a gendered form of healthcare that disproportionately affects women, though not, you know, it's not only women who are getting abortions. There are some people who do not identify as women. Some are men, some are non-binary. That inevitably impacts the right to gender affirming care. And we're seeing that, you know, in our current politics. Many of the same groups and the same organizations and the same movements that are pushing to restrict abortion are also pushing to restrict gender affirming care. And so when responding to those, many abortion rights organizations and LGBTQ rights organizations see this fight as a shared fight, and I think rightly so.
So talking about that movement, which is common to anti-abortion efforts and anti-trans efforts, let's talk a little bit about the historical context and the run-up to Dobbs. How did anti-abortion legislation evolve, especially following the 2010 midterms, which was an inflection point?
Yes. So 2010 was the rise of the Tea Party, right? This was the first midterm election after the election of Democratic President Barack Obama. The first midterm election after a president is elected is usually pretty bad for their party, but it was a bloodbath for Democrats that year. He called it a shellacking, Obama did. And the Tea Party came up, they arrived in Washington, and, you know, their movement was supposed to be a fiscal movement. It was supposed to be about kind of reducing government waste, reducing government spending, kind of reining that in. But as we've seen in the years since, and I think it was evident even then, many people aligned with the Tea Party movement, including people who were in elected office and leaders of groups and organizations, took very socially conservative positions on things that weren't technically part of the Tea Party platform. One of those was abortion. And so we just saw a flood of what are called trap laws, which is the targeted regulation of abortion providers passed by state legislatures in the, you know, decade after that, after the Tea Party came to Washington. And what's a trap law? It's things like, you know, mandating that facilities that provide abortion care have hallways that are a certain width to accommodate multiple patient gurneys side by side, even if that's not something that would ever happen in their day-to-day operations. It's something like a doctor at a clinic that provides an abortion, that provides abortions, needs to have admitting privileges at a hospital within a certain number of miles. Now, a lot of reproductive health care clinics, especially in places like the South, are in maternal health care deserts. They're in reproductive health care deserts. The reason they are where they are is because there isn't a hospital nearby. And so to require doctors to have an admitting privilege at a hospital in order to for the clinic to provide an abortion within, let's say, 30 miles is some of them, is essentially preventing them from providing abortions because there isn't a hospital within 30 miles. And these laws are passed intentionally. They're written in ways that only impact clinics that provide abortions and not other types of clinics. And that's intentional. And, you know, we saw a flood of those, and some of them, you know, got negated by the courts because they said, look, if you pass laws where the practical impact is that people can't access abortion, you know, that does not comply with Roe and a later case called Casey that requires people to, you know, not have a substantial burden to access abortion care. But some of them stood and some of them were still in place, you know, when Dobbs came out. And, you know, that's just a couple of examples of the way that the Tea Party movement kind of gave way to this really energetic push to restrict abortion around the country at the state level.
Amanda Becker, in this book, in You Must Stand Up, you also show that this was actually, there was a bipartisan, well, there was actually a lack of action on the part of Democrats in the run-up to Roe from 2010 to actually support abortion rights. And I think you give the example of Obama, who promised to protect abortion rights, and he said he would do it on day one and pretty much went by the wayside after he was elected. So how do you explain this?
Yeah, so when Obama was elected, ahead of his election, he said this was, you know, a top priority. It took a matter of weeks for that to change once he was in office. And a lot of it had to do with them, his administration, trying to get his Affordable Health Care Act enacted. In negotiations for that, there were a couple Democratic lawmakers who opposed abortion. And, you know, the parties are now nearly completely aligned on one side or the other. So there's a big disconnect between who we send to Washington and their stances are on abortion and voters. So while there are a lot of Republican voters who support abortion access in Washington, there are a couple Republican women in the Senate who support access, and that's pretty much it for Republicans. On the Democratic side, they now near universally support abortion rights. There are a couple people, men, one in the Senate who's leaving and another in the House who's staying, who do not support abortion access. And so during those negotiations, you know, the Obamacare law barely got through Congress, you know, if people can remember that. And they, you know, jettisoned protections for abortion in that to get it over the finish line. And some of the holdouts were actually Democrats that they were trying to change their minds, not Republicans.
So now let's turn to the impact on health care, the impact of abortion bans on maternal and infant health, which has been actually devastating, and we're seeing it more and more. For example, you talk about Alabama, you say its policymakers are making it harder to obtain an abortion while also ensuring it would be more dangerous to carry pregnancies to term. Explain.
Yes. So in Alabama specifically, there has been some wrangling over freestanding birth centers. So abortion is no longer legal in Alabama. So even the clinic I follow in the book is a great example, the West Alabama Women's Center, which now goes by its acronym. And they wanted to, post-Dobbs, transition to A, providing gender-affirming care, B, return to being a full-service birth center. Now, the clinic in a prior lifetime did, you know, provide the full spectrum of OBGYN care, including an up-to birth. The way that states are writing laws makes it incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to do that. They throw up roadblock after roadblock. So the clinic has a new doctor now, actually, from when I wrote the book, but she was trying to get, again, admitting privileges, because you need admitting privileges to deliver a baby if your clinic is not certified as a freestanding birth center, which is a whole process that's very political and has been difficult for many clinics to do. So she was trying to get admitting privileges. Now, again, this is once abortion is no longer legal in Alabama, to get admitting privileges to deliver babies at the local hospital. At hospitals, admitting privileges are a very opaque process. It's a board at the hospital who decides, and they can just say yes or no. And if they don't like that you've been affiliated with abortion care in the past, even if that's not part of your practice at the current time because it's banned, they can just not give you an admitting privilege. So that clinic was in a situation where they were prepared to offer low-income patients, people who desperately needed healthcare, full-spectrum prenatal care up to birth. And they were able to do that until birth. But then their patients had to just show up at the local emergency room to deliver their babies, which is not an ideal way to deliver your child with a doctor that you don't have a relationship with somebody who's not as familiar with your medical history. We see particularly bad outcomes for maternal health care in the South among women of color who, you know, there's structural racism in our medical system. And we are only beginning to see the impact that the Dobbs ruling will have, not just on women who are finding themselves in devastating situations and in some cases losing their lives because they can't access abortion care, but also the women who are going to be impacted by having to give birth in a situation that's less than ideal.
So this impact on maternal and child health, as a matter of fact, you talk about in the book, it also has an impact on doctors, on the very state of medical training in this country, on OBGYN residency programs. Talk about that impact.
Yeah, so I went to Wisconsin and, you know, met with some medical students who were campaigning ahead of a state Supreme Court election there. And, you know, Wisconsin had this very old law on the books when Dobbs came out that was an abortion ban, and it was going back and forth in the courts. And it was clear that eventually this would end up before the state Supreme Court if Wisconsin was unable to repeal it legislatively. And so these medical students were first years. They had shown up for medical school, you know, 6 weeks after Dobbs. And were, you know, medical students are busy, college students are busy. I'm not sure when they were applying ahead of Dobbs, it was on their radar that they might not be able to get the training they would need to go into reproductive healthcare specialties, depending on what happened with that decision. It was certainly clear to them after. And so they were out there at rallies and leafleting and handing things out ahead of that state Supreme Court election in which the justice who supported abortion rights was elected. And Wisconsin now has access to abortion again, not because of that decision, but because of a lower court decision, not the state Supreme Court at this point. But the medical students quickly realized, and in the first year after Dobbs, application rates to medical schools in states with strict abortion bans dropped. I think we'll continue to see that trend as we move forward. It's an acknowledgement that they're not only concerned that they aren't going to be able to get the training they need, but also, is it an ideal climate in which to practice medicine where your job is political and you could face personal retribution for providing care that other people in politics and in elected office disagree with? They're just choosing to go other places. And that exacerbates healthcare deserts, reproductive healthcare deserts in particular, because residents tend to end up building their practice afterward in the state where they trained. And so if they're not doing their residency in a state where they can practice medicine fully, they're not going to be able to do it in that state. They'll probably go elsewhere, or they'll just choose to do their residency in a place where they can get training. You know, if you are a resident, you're a full-fledged adult at that point. You might be married, you might have a partner, you might have children. If you're trying to do your residency in a state with an abortion ban, you're going to have to actually leave and do stints other places to get that training. That's expensive. It's, you know, additional logistical hurdles in your life to kind of go for 2 weeks or 4 weeks to another place to get that training. Because a lot of care, even if you don't want to go into the provision of abortion per se, miscarriage care is in many cases the exact same as abortion care. And, you know, we're seeing this in the headlines right now. Women who show up, patients who show up and cannot get abortion or miscarriage care because the hospitals are worried that it's an abortion and they could get in trouble.
The other part of that is also that women who are having medical emergencies in their pregnancy in the second and third trimester are also unable to get abortion care. You spoke of Arizona before. There's a clinic in Arizona which worked a creative way around this. This is one of the very few clinics in the country that actually does or used to provide abortion care in the second and third trimester. Now they've worked out an agreement with a neighboring state. Tell us what they did.
Yeah. So, and again, the reason they were one of the only clinics doing that was in part because the training is really hard to get to do those procedures later in pregnancy. And for anyone who's going to be caring for pregnant patients, that's important because you could miscarry at any time. So they worked out an agreement to do what's called induction abortions. And this is, again, was when the 15-week ban was in place. As of November 2024, abortion is now legal again in Arizona past 15 weeks because of a ballot measure there. But they worked out an agreement with a clinic in California. Basically, it was a group signal chat, which is an encrypted messaging platform of doctors and healthcare providers. And Dr. Goodrick in Arizona was talking to a doctor in California who was saying, you know, we're seeing all these patients come from Arizona who can no longer get abortion care past 15 weeks, and we're getting an influx. And Dr. Goodrick was like, I'm one of the few people in this country trained to do this past this point in pregnancy. And how can we work together to figure this out? And so what they came up with was they did something that's far more common in Europe than it is here, the induction abortion. A patient would travel from Arizona to California. The clinic in California would stop the heartbeat of the pregnancy and do the kind of initial stages of the abortion. And then they would come back to Arizona and essentially deliver their fetus at the Arizona clinic. And lawyers had advised Dr. Goodrick that complied with Arizona law at the time. Because the heartbeat had already stopped, it was no longer a viable pregnancy. And so therefore, she could do the induction part of that abortion because it was essentially birth care and post-birth care. So she was doing that in that period where the 15-week ban was in place. It created all sorts of additional details they needed to sort out. You know, how do you bill patients for a procedure that's conducted by two separate clinics? Different, you know, abortion funds would work with each clinic. So they really had to get creative, not only about how they delivered the actual medical care, but about looking at the fine print of the laws and regulations in their states, and also figuring out an entirely new billing system to kind of work with these patients.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. I'm talking with journalist and author Amanda Becker about her timely and important book, You Must Stand Up, The Fight for Abortion Rights in Post-Dobbs America. So much of the response to the abortion ban by abortion rights, people working for abortion access, has to do with medication abortions. The ability for these medications to be prescribed out of state, out of the states of states that have abortion bans. What are some states doing, like Massachusetts, to use shield laws to protect access to abortion medication? And what are the threats to abortion medication? Because that's happening too.
Yes, absolutely. So more than half of abortions are done by medication. And it makes it a pretty seamless process up until around 11 weeks. Because more than half of abortions are done with medication, that's now become the next biggest target of the anti-abortion movement, right? Because if more than half of people are doing something that you want to ban by a certain method, what's the best way to, you know, take your goal to the next level? It's restricting access to that method. And so that's why we're seeing too many efforts to talk about here at both the state and federal level to restrict access to the mifepristone, which is one of two of the main drugs used for medication abortion. So this has created, you know, more legal chaos, like we've talked about, with doctors somewhere where abortion is legal, worried that if they, you know, prescribe the medication potentially to somebody in a state like Texas, which not only has an abortion ban, but has tried to get very creative, as has Louisiana, about trying to prevent the residents of their state from, you know, accessing abortion care in other states. States like Massachusetts are passing what's called shield laws, which essentially says that they're not going to comply with any sort of laws from another state related to their doctors. You know, doctors are licensed by a state, so they will be protected in Massachusetts or another state that has a shield law, but not necessarily if they travel outside the state, right? And we haven't seen this yet, but doctors who I spoke to were kind of like going through this decision process of where can I deliver care? And this is usually via telemedicine, although sometimes people do travel across state lines for medication abortion. Asking themselves questions like, which states might I be okay never going to again? Because if I show up there, they may want to, you know, arrest me for medical care that I've provided to residents of their state while I was in my home state. These are actual decision-making processes that doctors are going through right now, such as, you know, should my children go to college in a state with a strict abortion ban if I might not be able to visit them there, if I'm worried about legal repercussions when I enter that state? So medication abortion and restricting it is kind of the next frontier of the anti-abortion movement. We heard about it a bit during the presidential campaign and the House and Senate campaigns in 2024, not nearly enough, I think, given its importance and kind of role it's playing in the overall healthcare ecosystem right now. And I feel pretty confident in anticipating that we are going to see more battles this year and in the years to come over ways that they might, you know, try to restrict access to mifepristone, whether that's, you know, it could be a law. It probably won't be a law passed by Congress at the federal level, but, you know, a lot of things can be done by a presidential administration through the various agencies that would make it effectively harder to get mifepristone, even if it's not a quote unquote ban.
And I think a lot of people think, a lot of people who live in states where abortion is still legal think that they're safe. But in fact, the threat to abortion medication by the Comstock Act, which is an act in place, just has not been used. Explain how that could threaten abortion access throughout the United States and also access to contraception.
Yes. So the Comstock Act is from the 1800s. It is an anti-obscenity law that prohibits shipping through the mail instruments related to abortion, along with a variety of other things they deemed obscene. And so that's, as you say, still on the books, just hasn't been enforced. Enforcement decisions are made by justice departments, and they're made by justice departments who are, you know, selected. The leaders are selected and picked by presidents. And so if you have an administration that wants to cut off access to mifepristone or any other medication or even medical implement related to abortion, you could just start enforcing the Comstock Act. And there's been an effort by Democrats to repeal the Comstock Act in Congress. They were not successful last Congress. They might try again, but they don't have the numbers. And so that is one way where just a change in policy at the Justice Department could make it much more difficult to get mifepristone and other things needed for abortions in a place like California, let's say, where abortion is protected. Now, we did see some Democratic governors after Dobbs start stockpiling medication abortion in anticipation that this would happen. And I don't know what their reserves are looking like at this point. If it's already in the state, you don't need to mail it across state lines. But that's a very, very real way that if, you know, if you're listening to this from Massachusetts or Maryland or California or New York, that is a way that your access to abortion could be constricted by a Justice Department and an administration that doesn't want people to access abortion.
And we should also say that they may restrict contraception in exactly the same way.
They absolutely could, using the Comstock Act. And repeatedly, at a couple points during the campaign, incoming President Donald Trump conflated mifepristone and contraception. This is something we also hear from members of Congress and state legislatures. There's a move in the anti-abortion movement to reclassify a lot of contraceptives as abortifacients. Now, this is not medically accurate, but it serves their purpose of further restricting healthcare to reclassify some of these things. So you might start to see, you know, more lawmakers talking about how Plan B is abortion. That is not true, but we will hear it. And even some other methods that are widely accepted as just contraception, there's kind of a push to redefine the language we use to talk about these things. It's not grounded in science or medicine. It's grounded in politics. And I think that is a conversation this country will be having over the next few years.
Another question is around the concept of fetal personhood. How could that impact the rights of women, people who are pregnant, and their ability to even have a pregnancy?
Yeah, so I was... Yes, as somebody who covers both politics and abortion, I was beside myself over the summer when I saw a lot of news organizations covering the release of the Republican Party's official platform ahead of their convention with headlines like Republicans soften stance on abortion. What was in the Republican platform related to abortion was very brief, like the entire platform overall. And it didn't endorse a certain number of weeks federal ban. So in that way, it backed off passing a federal law in Congress, you know, banning abortion after X number of weeks. And so that is why many organizations interpreted that as a softening of the official Republican Party stance on abortion. But what it did say was essentially, when you boil down the language, that they support states enacting fetal personhood protections. And there was a very clear nod to the Dobbs decision making this possible. And, you know, they said, we're going to protect the rights of all fetuses from conception. Essentially, the Republican Party platform was endorsing state-level fetal personhood. 14th Amendment rights to fetuses is another way you'll hear this said. This is very popular in the anti-abortion movement. Fetal personhood has been their goal since Roe. They've been working on this for nearly 50 years. This is what they want. Now, they know that the American public is not there. Not only do the American public voters support access to legal abortion, they really don't like the idea of fetal personhood. And that would essentially give a fetus from the moment it's conceived the same rights as you or I. And that, therefore, almost always inevitably leads to the person carrying the fetus having fewer rights because those rights start to collide. And so when I saw a platform that encouraged and supported states enacting fetal personhood laws, portrayed as a softening on abortion restrictions. That upset me from a journalistic standpoint because it just wasn't true. And I think that it was leaving voters with a very inaccurate idea of kind of what the end game is here. The end game of the anti-abortion movement and of a lot of the Republicans they support and who support them is fetal personhood. And that is far more restrictive than any ban based on a number of weeks could be.
Right. Well, there is so much more in this book. You also have some wonderful chapters on the organizing for protections for abortion access that happened in various states. Let's go out on some of the successes. You know, what are some of the most important ways that the movement to protect and enlarge abortion access is carrying out the...
Yeah, so one of the main ways we've seen, you know, Americans reclaim access to abortion and abortion rights is through citizen-referred ballot measures. Now, this is imperfect, and it's not something that people everywhere can look to as a way to regain access to abortion and get their rights back, because not all states have a ballot measure process as it relates to citizen-referred amendments. So, for example, people in Alabama do not have this available to them. Much of the South does not. But up until November 2024, anytime a measure was put before voters related to abortion, whether it was to protect abortion or to restrict abortion, abortion rights had won. It was undefeated going into the November elections. Now, in the November elections, there were a smattering of states that had ballot measures to protect abortion or to overturn abortion bans. We saw those succeed in most places. So in Montana, abortion is now protected. In Colorado, abortion is now protected. In Arizona, like we've talked about, abortion is now protected. In Missouri, abortion is now protected. These are places where rights were in flux, and voters resoundingly decided that abortion was going to be legal in their states, usually up until viability now. Now, there are other states that were more of a mixed bag. South Dakota, a measure failed. A measure also failed in Nebraska, but Nebraska actually had two different measures. So it was really confusing, and it was unclear kind of whether that confusion would lead to it passing or failing. It did fail. In Florida, a constitutional amendment failed that would have protected abortion up to viability, but they require more than a 50% majority to pass a ballot measure. So 57% of people in Florida actually voted for that, but it still failed because it needed to hit 60. So I think that that's one way where voters are really showing their strength. You know, a majority of Americans support abortion access, including a majority in nearly every state, not every state, but nearly every state. And, you know, this will be something that will continue, I think, until kind of the list of states where this process is available is exhausted. But again, for people in a place like Alabama, this is not something available to them. And I think that's always important to remember. Some of the people getting hardest hit by these abortion bans and losing access to healthcare are not able to bring it back with a ballot measure. So really, that requires a kind of sea change in state legislatures up to Congress. And that kind of, I think, is the next frontier for the abortion rights movement after the ballot measure states are exhausted. And these two things will probably be happening in tandem. But it's going to require electing different people who will enact laws that reflect the will of voters. And that's going to be a long process. I do think there is a path to restore abortion rights, but it was a 50-year project to undo Roe. And so I don't think people can expect it to be a short process to respond to Dobbs. I think that it could be a multi-year process, potentially a multi-decade process. And to be successful, people will have to play the long game, just like the anti-abortion movement did.
Well, those are sobering words, but they contain some hope within them. It's just a terrific book and a real page-turner. You Must Stand Up. Amanda Becker, it's just been such a thrill to talk with you about this important topic. It's something that everybody needs to take seriously and fight for justice on. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
You Must Stand Up is out from Bloomsbury Press. Next week on Writer's Voice, we talk with Cassidy Randall about her thrilling history of the harrowing and heroic story of the first all-women's ascent of Denali, 30 Below. Don't miss it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, check out our archives, and find out more about this week's guests at writersvoice.net. You can find our social media links there too. And don't forget to subscribe, like, and link to our podcast. It really helps to spread the word about the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.